Alan, thank you for the invitation. It's wonderful to be here at Collège de France. I've been here a couple of times, in fact, in this room. The only thing that I see different is that the people who are familiar to me got a little bit older. So I designed this four series in a relatively simple way in order to... I don't want to disappoint you with the first lecture, but the first one will be very complicated. The second one will be also complicated, and then we are getting to the simpler and simpler ones. So the reason why I start with this one is because I think this is the most important story that I'd like to convey, namely how we build something like this, cognition, and how can a neurophysiologist working mostly on rats contribute to this. So let me start with a long list of things here that are all familiar to you. Most of you who are in this room and work in neuroscience, they would say, I recognize at least one or two of the items there. I already early on decided that I'm going to dedicate my entire life working out the mechanisms of brain mechanism of this. You may be interested in perception, you may be interested in memory, habits, and so on. Is there anybody in this room who cannot find and identify himself or herself with this list? Not one. That's very interesting, because this is a list from a book written in 1890. Somebody can tell me who has written that book? James. Oh, yeah, the back one. So anybody recognizes the name William James from the younger generation? Okay, one, two. Did you know that this list is from his book? No. So this is a very interesting thing. You can come forward. The reason for that is that William James he synthesized this knowledge. Where did he synthesize this knowledge from? From nowhere else than from the British empiricist. And the British empiricist learned this list from somewhere else, which is the Christian philosophies. And the Christian philosophers got most of these ideas from even older ones. And you can imagine that Aristotle could have made this list. Now, if you are with me, then you can say that's super embarrassing and super interesting also, because this list was made up by people who had no clue that the brain has anything to do with these. So the list, of course, these are all discrete boundary works, so we tend to believe that there are things like memory, there is things like motivation, there is such a thing as perception, but these were concocted by our predecessors with cognitive boundaries. And cognitive neuroscience became enslaved to this philosophy, trying to find mechanisms in the brain with the same boundaries. How naive this is. We inherited the independent variables, and we are trying to work out the dependent variables, which is the brain mechanism. So how did we get there? Of course, William James was not the first guy. There were some other attempts before. You know, this was this crazy guy, Gall, who thought to do something like this. We already had the list. We just have to find mechanisms. Since he didn't even have access to EEG, he didn't know anything what to do, he thought that the bumps on the skull are probably the key to explain the boundaries of those concocted words that I just showed you. So we ridicule Gall for his attempt to associate bumps with cognitive items, but that's not the major crime he has done. The major crime what he has done, of course, is that he believed that those items are actually real. And he tried to find boxes in the brain or outside the brain, in this case the skull, for those items. This is what I call boxology. Now, of course, this was crazy back then, but today is a different world, you know, because now we are trying to do with fMRI and all those complicated things. We put microelectrodes in the brain, we image the brain, and so on. And then the list got a little bit longer over the years, and we try to put them. All of these items are looking for a home in the brain, but some items don't find a home in the brain. And if we have no clue where these things are, we just put them in the prefrontal cortex. And I have a similar long list also for the parietal cortex. And of course, those are the hippocampal maniacs. They will recognize that in the hippocampus, we've got the same problem. It's not now the structure, but within the structure, we are looking for neurons. And now almost every single neuron has a name. So obviously we have a problem. And how did we get here? The way how we get here is by the philosophy, as I already mentioned, the British empiricist assumed that what we have to understand is how the brain perceives the world. The entire thing, in the entire two volume of William James, there is only a few things about action. But everything else is about complicated stuff such as consciousness and motivation and emotion and so on, like, and so on, and perception. Why is that? It's because the philosophy that was driving this research says that the goal of the brain, or the sole function of the brain, is learn about the truth of the world. And we don't have to go very far, of course, because this is exactly what we call today in the Bayesian learning. We have to get evidences out there because the brain is there to perceive. But a brain, the brain's main goal is not to perceive at all and understand the truth at all. The brain's goal is to control the body and help the survival of the body. So if you don't buy into this, then you go back to the lab and do what everybody has been doing. Namely, we pick a problem, we go into the brain, and we correlate the problem, such as vision, with correlates in the brain. That this is what we do, whether we do human fMRI research, whether we are looking at the laboratory with microelectrodes, what we do is this, we correlate things. And this is, of course, started in France. Because the idea, again, the Cartesian thinking was also about how do we get the veridical knowledge outside the world. And the fundamental problem with this approach is that the experimenter is in a super privileged situation. It is only the experimenter who has access to both the outside world and the activity in the brain. So when you find some relationship, then you say and declare and you write up a paper, I found a code. But that code is a fake code. It's a false code because coding is an agreement between the sender and the receiver. In this case, the receiver is the human experimenter, but not the neurons inside the brain. Neurons inside the brain, I have no clue whatsoever what they are seeing. All they know is what action potentials are arriving to them from upstream regions. In other words, there is no easy way to ground the problem. In cognitive science and psychology, this is called the grounding problem. How do you know what the meaning of these things out there without a second opinion? And what I'd like to claim is that the second opinion that is provided to the same neurons whose activities are changing as a result of the incoming inputs is action, is an output from the brain. So we need to have at least two things. And when you have two things, one can be compared with the other one. If you just have one thing, there is no grounding, there will be no understanding, there could be no meaning. So this is, of course, not only, you know, I picked Hubel and Wiesel because they are the heroes of our neuroscience. They were the very best, and we generated enormous amount of knowledge with this approach. But nevertheless, it's a dead end. So we have to try something else. But it's not only him, but I'd like to show you another very best, which is John O'Keefe. And unfortunately, somehow there is a plot here at the College of France because none of my movies are working. What I wanted to show you is a rat running around here, but you have seen many of these things, and that particular neuron, this one single neuron that I'm showing up here, has a high activity here. It's called the place field. So why there is a place field? And again, the idea is that the reason why there is a place field here is because the constellation of the environment is such that it makes this neuron to fire. In other words, John O'Keefe and his colleagues made the hippocampus an honorary V1. That is, it's still a perceptual system. This is still controlled by the outside world. Now, imagine that In 1971, or in 1970, it's 1971 when this was the discovery of Plaisir, somebody in Collège de France does the same experiment, but somehow misses the hippocampus. And it goes a little bit forward, more forward, and recoils from the lateral septum. Now, in the same paradigm that O'Keefe has used, everybody in the room knows John O'Keefe's work, right? Okay. So this is what you would see. Absolutely nothing. It's totally uninteresting because, again, there is no grounding here. All you can see is that in the lateral septum, the unit is doing this. You move on, this is not very interesting. Unless you are smarter and you say, oh, at the same time, I record from the hippocampus and I look at the field potential. This is called the theta oscillation. And from the theta oscillation, I can assign every single spike to the phase of the theta cycle. And all of a sudden, on the right, you see a different picture emerges. Now, from the lateral septal, together, this is a unit activity, I have a second opinion, which is the hippocampal theta oscillation, and I can ground the relationship between one thing and the other thing, which is where the animal is. So, if I recorded, or you recorded, from this neuron with this knowledge, then you would declare that the lateral septum is the GPS of the brain. And there is no further argument that you can make. Of course, you can make other arguments that we can make lesions and so on. But from the recording alone, without further experiments, you have the right to say that I'm the winner, not the hippocampus. And you can spend 20 years arguing back and forth, you know, whether it's the lateral septum or not. So, as I already mentioned, the way how you can ground things is by a trick, which is action. Now, you can say, I remember last time I was here, there was a sign on the second floor somewhere, held, it was Alain Berthoz's laboratory, the Perception Action Lab, or something like this. And I told him this should be the action perception, because action is the primary and perception is the secondary thing. Now, the reason why there is a difference here is because if you think about perception action cycle, it means something comes in and then something comes out. An inevitable consequence of this logic is that there should be some special in the middle. And the special thing in the middle is the little man, the homunculus, or in today's vocabulary, we call it the decision maker. And many people in many colleagues are working on decision making, not knowing that this is a medieval idea. It comes from the Bible. It comes from St. Augustine, who said that we, man, not women, man, are created to try to learn the truth of the world, know and learn and accept what is good and bad, choose the good, which is me, and then you can go to heaven. And you have to make a decision. So you have to accumulate over time the evidences of the truth of the world and so on. So that is not a very effective way, I would say, but there is a trick here. The trick here, when you look at the action perception concept, is whenever the brain generates a pattern, eventually it can lead to an output. The output could be muscular action, it could be an autonomic action, it could be release of peptides and a number of other things. Or thoughts. Thoughts are also actions, as I will try to convince you a little bit later. Now, every single time the brain generates an output, it also sends something back to the perceptual system. So this is already a very good trick because the perceptual system can now see two things. One is what is internally generated, and the other one is what's coming from the outside. And this way, and only this way, the brain can say, I know that I am the agent of my own actions. Of course, this is not my idea. This is called the corollary discharge. Two people came up, or three people came up to this idea independently. It's a very deep organizational principle. This is called also reafferenz, depending whether you side with the Germans or with the Americans. The bottom line is what I told you exactly, is that at the same time when you send out a copy to the outside world, you send a negative copy of that thing And now you can compare whether it's you who are changing, who is changing your perceptual world or somebody else. Close your eye, one of your eyes, and start moving with your finger the remaining eye. Just try to do it quicker. Do it. Okay? Not just one eye. Okay, cover one eye and move the other eye by your hand. If you haven't done it yet, it will be a surprise. The entire world is moving. However, when you look at yourself in the mirror, you don't even see that your eyes are moving. Your eyes are always stationary, and because of this mechanism. So both of these groups have said, this is what happens, that the reafferentation allows there will be a mirror image, a negative image, and a positive image, and when you are doing the perception or you are doing the changes, then you don't see things. So now you can compare your actions with something else, and then you can have the truth. So if action is so important, how does it continue doing something interesting throughout evolution and eventually lead us to cognition? Of course, I'm not pretending I will give you the answer, but I try to speculate. So the first speculation is this. There is a very simple hypothetical organism. Let's look at this one. You know, this could be a fly or it could be a mosquito's brain. And the goal of this brain is to predict the consequences of the agent's actions. It can move the sensors, optimize the position of the sensors, and be away and predict the future. Now, the reason why brains are good in predicting the future is because we live in a world where there are recurrences and regularities. If there would be no regularities, there would be no recurrences, the brains would be very useless. So this brain is very, very useful because it can predict the future, but it's because it's such a simple brain, it's useful only in predicting the future in a very short time scale and in a very simple environment. Now, what happens over the evolution is that we add a loop to this, and another loop, and another loop, and keep adding loops between the input and the output, or between the output and the input. So the brains are getting smarter and smarter because of these complicated loops. The goal of this brain is exactly the same as this one, to predict the future or predict the consequences of its own actions, but now in a very complicated, noisy environment and over many, many, many time epochs. It could be months and years. You go to college because you can predict the consequences of your actions. What happens if you go to college, if you choose this versus going to do something else. Now, but this is not enough for cognition. At some point, and I'm not pretending this is a sequential thing because it happens in parallel all the time, but for didactic reasons, I separate this, you need a magic moment. The magic moment is to disengage the world. Now you would like to disengage the world, and now what you do with the help of the corollary discharge, the reafferentation system, is you are peeking into the same system as you did before without acting out. Now the brain can generate what-if scenarios. That is, what if I do this, what if I do that, without actually doing it. And this is the right definition of, or at least one definition of cognition. So with the rest of my talk, I'd like to illustrate how these ideas have at least some merit. So let's start at the very beginning. That was a beautiful movie that doesn't work either, but you know what would happen here, right? So there are kicks. Every single expectant mother knows that baby kicks are very important. The presence of baby kicks correlate with the Apgar score and also your IQ 20 years later. So this is important. But we have no clue why it is good for the brain. Luckily, simple organism, and this was also a beautiful movie. Have you ever seen rat pups in a litter or mouse pups? Who has seen them? What do? They keep moving. They are like popcorn, you know, and some of them are jumping up and down and so on. So they are doing a lot of work, just like the same way how the fetus in humans do. So we would like to know, or we wanted to know, when I was in France, in Paris, in my mini sabbatical here, is that how is it possible that the gen generate these patterns, and what are the useful things that come back from it? To make the long story short, this is a stochastic process. The stochastic process is such that either the release of acetylcholine on the muscles is stochastic, or the spinal cord generates stochastic patterns, and sometimes only a finger is moving, sometimes you've got a flexion reflex, sometimes you've got a whole body jerk or startle reflex. So we started recording from various parts of the brain, and what we found is that in a newborn animal, which corresponds the red pup, which corresponds to about the shift between the second and third trimester of pregnancy in humans, there is nothing in the cortex or in the hippocampus, just zero activity. And all of a sudden, there is a big activity. And luckily, we recorded also from the movement and of these pups, and we realized that every single time there is a jerk or there is a movement, then you got this big activity here. If you zoom in, what you find is actually it's a beautiful pattern. It's an oscillation. So the very first organized pattern that emerges in the mammalian brain is an oscillation. And if you look at the frequency and the shape, if there are any neurologists here, they would say, oh my God, this looks like a sleep spindle. Except that's not a sleep, because the animal at this age, it's very hard to differentiate different stages of waking and sleep. If you look at the high brain, yes, but if you look at the forebrain, the independent of the state of the brain just does this and or nothing, this or nothing, this or nothing. But every one of them, it turned out, if you look at very carefully the animal, every one of them that emerges is associated one or the other. One spindle or no spindle. And in fact, it has a nice topography in the somatosensory and motor area representation. So for example, when the tail is switching or the head is switching, then you can see very different patterns, and there is a nice body map. But it's an interesting correlation, but we have no clue why is it good for the brain. Now, we have about 620 or so muscles. If we would put all these 620 muscles on the table here, and they would be still connected to the brain through the spinal cord, and they would be twitching, that would buy nothing for the brain. However, these muscles are anchored to the skeleton. So their degree of freedom is decreased tremendously. Those that are agonistic or antagonistic will have a different patterns up there. Those things from this mechanical movement that are agonistic, they will signal to the somatosensory cortex about the neighboring area, about the same place. And it happened in the same time. If something happens in the same time, it could be bound somehow by some mechanisms in the brain. So this is a dumb teacher. Dumb teacher because a stochastic teacher is just generating patterns. What makes it smart is the skeletal system, because it makes it useful for the body. They learn to learn something about your body scheme. You know, remember, when we are born, we have no clue how far the nose is from the finger. But we have to find the distance. That has to be calibrated. But a week later, that knowledge is not very useful because the distance changed. So you have to relearn it. All the time. And you also have no knowledge whether you are born with two hands or two legs. If you want, if one of your leg is missing, no problem. The brain can accommodate for it very easily. Or if your foot is broken during birth, the brain accommodates it and ignores that foot for a long period of time until you remove the cast and the body will accept it. So the point is that this is a mechanism that allows you to learn your body scheme, that it's not a snake, it's not a soccer ball, but it is what it is. So this is a useful thing to do, but it disappears in the rat at about age 14 or so. It disengages from the environment. This sleep spindle that I just mentioned now can happen independent of what happens in the outside world. It can get internalized. So internalization is the term I like to use for disengagement from the world. Now, this disappearance, in this case, is not absolute, not perfect. When you go home for tonight and you will fall asleep, you just watch yourself. Sometimes you have a movement like this. Occasionally, the startle reaction is big enough, you almost fall out of bed. If you record your EEG activity, you will see that a spindle is associated with it. Okay? But most of the time, the brain gets disengaged. So my next couple of examples for disengagement comes from the area that we are sort of familiar with. This is spatial navigation. The hippocampus is a famous device because it supposedly supports spatial navigation. Now, navigation has several necessary components. So imagine yourself coming to New York City, and you take the subway, and you come out of the subway with a map in your hand. The first thing you have to do is orient that map, right? You have to figure out which direction is north. For that, you need a head direction system, and we have it. The second one is that there are X and Y coordinates on the map, and that's a grid. And the grid helps you to see how far the Central Park is from NYU and so on. So we have that. This is the grid system. And the third thing you need is to locate yourself. So this is a non-egocentric or allocentric representation, and you need an egocentric representation, and that's the placer system. You need one more thing. We don't know how it works, which is calibrate the map. How far is NYU from the Empire State Building? If it is in walking distance, you make one decision. If it takes 2 hours, you take a cab. So these are the elements that you need. So let's start with the head direction system. So how does the head direction system work? Alan Bertoz and his colleagues Sidney Wiener have devoted several years to figure out. And what they learned, of course, is that head direction cells are at many, many places in the brain. Those neurons that classify can be classified head direction system, they fire continuously when I'm looking at the direction. And then I turn my hand, there will be another set of neurons that fire here, and another neuron, and for the 360 degrees, there will be always neurons that will be firing in a beautifully tuned manner. If you take me to another room, the head direction system will be active, but now it's in a different orientation. So it's not looking at it's not a compass looking at the north, but it's an improvised head direction system. It's an improvised compass. Now, what is driving this, and where are these neurons? As I mentioned, they are present in the brainstem, in the supramammillary nucleus, the mammillary bodies, the anterior dorsal nucleus of the thalamus, the presubiculum, the parasubiculum, endocrinal cortex, layer 5, layer 6, parietal cortex, many, many places. So Charles Sherrington, does anybody know who is Charles Sherrington? Younger generation? Okay, very important, very bright physiologist, said, if something is important for the survival of the animal, it is represented in a redundant, degenerative way. There are multiple representations. So, by his words, this is a very important system, a very important sense, if you want, because it's represented at multiple places. So, what is the origin of this? The vestibular system, the vision, optic flow, tactile flow, neck muscles, and all sorts of things. But again, the idea behind is that the reason why these neurons are firing is because somebody is driving them. Something must energize them. It's called the Newtonian thinking. There is nothing moves in the world unless it is being moved, and this is Newton. So our entire thinking in neuroscience is the Newtonian thinking. So they have to be driven by any of those things that I just mentioned to you. So with a Frenchman, Adrien Perrache, we thought about this a little bit, and we said, okay, this is an interesting thing, but what are those things that are associated with sensory areas, they are driven by the sensory cues, do when they are disengaged from the world? And the easiest thing to study disengagement from the world is during sleep. Sleep is a default pattern of the brain. A sleep pattern always tell you what's wrong with that brain. What was altered with this brain? You can read out the entire life experience of an individual just by studying sleep. So in this case, what we did is recorded from a bunch of anterodorsal nucleus cells that I showed here. These are spikes, activity is a little bit organized. And then we have the head direction that we can measure with two LEDs. So there is a relationship between the two. The experimenter knows the direction of the head of the animal. He knows the LED position. He can correlate the two, make a predictor, make a neural network, and predict the position of the animal from the output of the spikes. And you can see that the red and the predicted one is pretty good. So now we ask, what happens if the animal falls asleep? And the answer is, not much. Or if it happens, then it's an interesting way how it was organized. This looks like not very similar, but I'm trying to convince you. First of all, I'd like to tell you that when you look at REM sleep, you can see that indeed the eyes are, the virtual eyes are moving. The eyes is not moving, of course. The head is not moving. Nothing is moving. But we can predict which direction the animal is looking at while in REM sleep. And the head direction system moves in a pretty much similar way as in the waking state. Now, when the animal is in non-REM sleep, it's a little bit more dense, and the reason why you don't see it, I will tell you in a second. But this is also organized exactly the same way. What am I saying? What I'm saying is that we already agreed that if I'm looking at this one, it's 0 degrees, a set of neurons are firing. If I turn my head, then the 30-degree neurons will be firing now. And then I keep my head turning, and always a different set of neurons will be firing in this order. And the explanation is because I'm turning my head. But now, during sleep, there is no head turning. Yet, 30 degrees come after 0, 60 degrees come after 30, and so on. Now, what happens in non-REM sleep, that it is the same exact things that happen. Now the ring goes around 10 times faster. It's much faster. That is, I'm turning my virtual head at a speed that the muscles cannot do, because muscles have a limitation how fast they can move. So why am I saying what I said? It's because we have data to support that. So if two neurons are representing the same direction, then they coincide in time. So not surprising, then these neurons, you know, these two head direction cells are firing together. If I'm taking two neurons that are representing two different opposite head directions, of course they never fire together, therefore they have a negative correlation. If you have a positive correlation and have a negative correlation, you would like to figure out what is the zero correlation. That is when there is no relationship to do. And the answer is, it happens when the two are related to each other at 60 degrees. Okay? Now, you can do the same thing now with many neurons. These were just two neurons, pairs of neurons. Now, every line here is a pair of neurons, just many of them. And you can see that there are neurons that are positively correlated, there are neurons that are negatively correlated, and this is the no man's land. And that happens to be at about 60 degrees. And about one-third of the neurons are positively correlated, two-thirds of the neurons are negatively correlated. So why is it interesting that it's 60 degrees? Does it matter? Would it be more exciting if it would be 69 or 72? Any clue? Any suggestion? How many of you know about the grid cells? So there I showed you the Nobel discovery by the Mosers. The grid is 60 degrees. The grid of the entorhinal cortical neurons is 60 degrees. And they declared that this is made in the entorhinal cortex, because this is where they found it. Later on, they found it also the presubiculum, parasubiculum, and there are now some very smart people, especially University College London, who are doing fMRI experiments, and they indirectly find grid organization almost in every complicated system, such as the parietal cortex and prefrontal cortex and elsewhere. So this is a fundamental organization that may or may not have to do anything with the geometry, but this very simple head direction system maybe is giving you already what you need. I have to add one sentence here. If you destroy the head direction system, the grid disappears. So there is no complication without the complicated or complex organization of the entorhinal cortex without these. And it already has the 60-degree organization. So what do we have learned so far? What we have learned so far is, initially, perhaps this system is driven exclusively by the output, by the sensory inputs. And if you compare this system, which is driven by some sensory inputs, for example, with a similar system in a moth, and you show light to the moth 2 million times, as long as the animal is not completely tired, then 2 million times the animal will move back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. This is a smarter system. It moves also when we are asleep, but it can do something that can ignore. I can close my eyes and I still remember my head direction. Or something walks across my vision field and I still remember it. In other words, what we do with this internalization process that is making it an attractor around the ring is that when some perturbation happens, you can completely ignore it, you can interpolate, or you can extrapolate. And these two operations, interpolation and extrapolations, are, of course, the most important predictive or cognitive operations we have. So how much of this is self-organized and how much is controlled by internal organization? Is self-organized, how much is externally input? And the answer is shown here. So it's a complicated thing. What we wanted to do here is predict the occurrence of spikes in the target posterior subiculum region from the activity of the thalamic head direction systems. And this is the goodness of the prediction. And you can see that the total capacity of the system is this. If you take away the sensory system, all of them, then we lose only this much. The rest is there. Indeed, the sensory systems add. No denial about that. Of course, it's very, very important. But it's riding on a large tsunami, which is a pre-existing dynamic. Okay? So this is the summary of this part that I said, okay, this is what we get. And indeed, this is a huge claim. It's just a claim, it's not even a strong hypothesis, that indeed, maybe the head direction system is the precursor of the 60-degree organization of the grid system. Now, 2 years or 3 years fast forward, the Mosers looked at this kind of thing in the anterolateral cortex and looked at their own grid system. And they said, if two neurons are completely overlapping, that the two grid neurons are firing, and they are firing in exactly the same topographic manner, right this one, then they are positively correlated. And they are causatively correlated also during REM sleep and non-REM sleep. If they are completely phase offset, as is shown here, this is the blue and the gray one, then they are negatively correlated. And there is something also in between. The beauty of this is that the correlations are also 5 to 10 times faster during non-REM sleep, just like what I have shown you with the head direction system. So there is an internal dynamic that cuts across boundaries of structures that drives the system at a much faster pace during non-REM sleep than during REM and waking. The further wonderful similarity, remember I said 30% of the neurons were positively correlated and about two-thirds of them were negatively correlated. And this is exactly the same pattern in the anterolateral cortex. So it seems that this self-organization and internally generated patterns are so persuasive in multiple systems. So why don't we look at it in other parts, which is the anterolateral hippocampal system, which is a navigation system, or the other components of the navigation system. Navigation comes in two flavors. Everybody kind of agrees with that. One is called egocentric, the other one is called allocentric. Now, what does it mean? What it means is that I can move around in a city or in a room based on my idiothetic information from my body. I can keep track of my movements, turn around, even if I'm blindfolded, I can come back to the place where I came from. All I have to remember is the distance, the direction, or the time and direction, and then from any point, I can make the shortest cut back to where I came from. Now, this is needed for exploration in order to generate a world map. A map can be constructed only if every square inch of that world has been already explored. So that requires exploration. So once you explore a world, I can make a map, and I give it to you. And as long as you can read the map, then you can orient yourself everywhere. So this is a system that is explicit knowledge. This is externalized from the brain. It no longer is mine. It has nothing to do with me because I generalize and everybody can read it. But this is me. Now, this is hippocampus anterolateral cortex dependent. Now, for the same amount of years, for 1971, in fact, it's a little bit earlier, Brenda Milner and Scoville said, no, the hippocampus is about memory. And in fact, on the other side, there are also two types of memories that we say they come together in one group that are called declarable memories, which means these are memories that we can consciously declare. I can tell you, I know what exactly it means. And it also has two components, what is called episodic memory, which is the discovery I make in the laboratory. But once I made that discovery public and the other groups will confirm it, they come in from different angles, just the way how the people and this, the explorers can come from different angles here, and then they make a node here, that's the node because the exploration happened from here to here, and they know there is a node. The nodes in the cognitive space corresponds to explicit knowledge, it's also called semantic information. So semantic information is personless, this is the computer, this is the pointer, and so on, whereas self-reference memory is mine. This is super important, of course, and in my next talk I will dedicate a lot of time talking about this. But what happened over 30, 40 years is that we had an allocentric map, and we as a community, they said, oh, all we need is an arrow from here to here, and then we solve the problem. The answer is we didn't solve it, because this is the, in my opinion, this is the direction to go, and this is the direction to go. What am I saying here? What I'm trying to say is that nature initially figured out a way how can help the animal to orient itself in the environment with the help of outside cues. But once the system got a little bit smarter, then it no longer has to rely on the environment. It can do its own what-if travels inside. This is what we call mental travel. And when we travel forward into the future, we call it planning or imagination. And when we go back into the past, then we will say it is memory. So we've got two different words for that. One is called postdiction, the other one is prediction, or memory and planning. Over the past 5 or 6 years, it turned out that every system under the fMRI that people have seen being active during imagination or planning was exactly the same as people for many years associated with the memory system. More about this at my next talk. Now, back to this, just say, now there are two different ways of thinking about place cells. So the reason why place cells are here and one after the other, you could say, is because they are driven by the outside world. P1 comes after P2 because P1 is activated by my medal. And P2 is activated by something else, and the animal is moving in the world. But if that were the whole story, I wouldn't be able to give you this talk. The reason why I can give you this talk is because there is a mechanism in my brain which started with the initial condition when Alan introduced me. And from then on, that assembly that was associated with Alan now is giving rise to another assembly, and another assembly, and another assembly. And my assembly organization can go forever as long as you don't stop me. So this is the other alternative. How do we figure this out? What we can do in such a difficult situation is to take the best theory out there, which was John O'Keefe's theory, which is this one. The theory is very good because it's explicit. It says, for every single coordinate of the Cartesian space, there should be a subset of neurons which will fire forever, as long as you are awake. Okay? So there is another one that has to do with the theta phase and so on, but this is enough. You have to find neurons that will identify every single part of the environment. If you record from 200,000 CA1 pyramidal cells somewhere in this beautiful office that I have been this morning in Ella's, or you take the rat to one laboratory, another laboratory, eventually every single pyramidal cell will fire because they are all place cells. Now, what if somehow magically we freeze the animal here and now and maintain the theta oscillation? Then we should find a set of neurons that will fire forever and everybody else should be completely silent. And this is what we did with Eva Pashtalkova. And it's a very simple task, which is called the spatial alternation task, where the animal finds water and said, next time I should go to the other side. left, right, left, right. The only trick we did is that in between the choices, we asked the rat to face this always in the same direction and run at about the same speed. So in our power, we have done everything that was possible to keep the external world and the internal reafferentation from the body constant. And now we are looking for answers. The answers would be that if the theory is right about the external control, then this neuron, for example, should fire on trial one continuously, forever, and on every single trial, or be completely silent. And of course, this is not what we found. What we found is this. This is trial one, trial two. The red colors indicate strong activity of the neuron. And so you can say this neuron likes to be active at about 1.5 seconds every single trial. This one is somewhere else and so on. Now you can collapse these trials into the session mean, and then you get these ones. And if you have many, many of these, if you record from large enough number of neurons, then the entire journey will be represented continuously by these neurons. Now, the beauty of this and the interesting thing is that their lifetime, that is how long they are active, is exactly the same as if the animal would be walking around freely in the environment. In fact, if I give this to Michael Zugaro or his group, and they don't know whether I recorded the animal from running in a wheel or in a free world, then you will find the same thing. So now this is an interesting thing, because if you have enough, then the entire world can be tessellated by neural subset. Now, this is a very good trajectory. We call it trajectory or sequences. Very important, because somewhere here is the information whether I came from the right or I came from the left. I'm going to the right. I'm going to the future, in the future, to the left, is embedded. We just have to figure it out how. And this was the movie that doesn't show what we're supposed to show, but I'm showing it in the next slide. So what I show you here is the same set of cells that I have shown here, but now we can separate each neuron depending whether the animal is going to the right or going to the left. Let me go back one here. So for example, this neuron that I wanted to show you in sound likes to fire here when the animal will choose the left arm in the future. And it's completely silent, or most of the time it's silent when the animal is choosing the right arm. And this is the opposite, but at different times. Now we can have many of these neurons, and we need many of these neurons because this neuron is beautifully predicting whether the animal will go to the right or to the left, but it's completely useless to guide navigation. Why is that? It's because its lifetime is very short. It stops firing here, so it has to give this information to another neuron, and another neuron, and another neuron, until the animal comes to the junction of the T-mate and says, oh, this is the trajectory I have to continue. So this is shown here. Now, each of these lines corresponds to a neuron. We, the experimenters, made this trajectory, but now we have a control here because these are the same sequence of neurons here than there, but this one is when the animal is going to the left and the other one is going to the right. So we could make this selection and we'd make one trajectory. Of course, we could make another trajectory here based on the right turn or right choices, but then this would be very different. So if you look at these two graphs, you don't need a hell lot of statistics to predict that I can take any time windows and I can predict from the time window, from the population activity of the neuronal firing in any time window, to predict that the animals will go and choose one side or the other side. That is, it makes a decision 15, 20 seconds later, including errors with 90% accuracy with just a few hundred neurons. So I wanted to show this movie, but I can skip it. And this is the kind of beginning that we came back. So what we concluded is that the hippocampus just can't help. It generates sequences under all or most conditions. So I'm giving this talk to you all the time, continuously. Nobody asked the question yet. But if you ask the question, that's a perturbation. And then this trajectory, that is a predetermined trajectory whose cause depends only on the initial condition, can change. Because with your question, I can jump. And the more questions you ask, or would have asked, the more different this talk would be. Because I would follow the trajectory that is imposed upon me rather than what is self-organized. So this is true, but this alone is not true. So, you know, we can do what we like very much in the lab is to reject somebody else's hypothesis. How am I doing with time? Okay. So now I'd like to show you something about mechanisms also, because now it became a very interesting question. I'm telling you that most of the things that are exciting are self-organized. So we would like to know from this, what I have said so far, what determines this sequential organization? The second question is, what determines the lifetime of the neurons? Why is it that it lasts about 1 second in the hippocampus? And we looked at the prefrontal cortex, other people looked at the parietal cortex, and wherever people looked at, it's about the same. So the first question we ask is that this trajectory looks very continuous. And of course, this in this very simple theta cycle embedded in 300 years or 500 years of philosophy about the past, the present, and the future. And you can see this is continue. It's very difficult to say which one is past or which is the future. In fact, when the animal comes from the right, the trajectory starts from the reward and it goes to the wheel, and then it goes all the way until the animal goes to the opposite direction. We could figure out whether the code is mostly for the future or the past only by looking at errors. Otherwise, the whole thing is just the same. But those errors, remember, these are called commission errors, which means that they are not occurring because you did something to the animal, but they occur because the animal believes that it was encoding the past in a wrong way. The only reason why the animal is making a left turn because it believed that it was rewarded on the right side. So again, the past, future, and the present was continuous. So let's see what is causing this, and I give you away the answer. This is inhibition. Now, this was a couple of years earlier when there were only two types of Cre lines available to manipulate different types of neurons, parvovirus types and somatostatin types. In the hippocampus, they come into broad classes. The somatostatin neurons typically go to the dendrites. In the hippocampus, these are called OLM neurons, or the majority of them. They go to the distal dendrites of the pyramidal cells. Distal dendrites of the pyramidal cells. And the parvovirus continuing neurons are typically innervating the soma or the perisomatic region. This is where the CA3 association system comes in. So we wanted to see what happens if you switch off one, you switch off the other, and so on. And back then, everything was complicated. So in order to get all these things to the head of the animal, we had to fix the head of the animal. Don't do it. It's a terrible thing to do. But many people are doing head fix preparations these days. So it turns out that in this treadmill, when the animal is running and there are objects on the treadmill, the neurons generate sequences in the hippocampus, despite the fact that the distal cues remain exactly the same. And remember, the two-dimensional egocentric navigation should or expected to depend on changes of the external cues, yet we got very nice sequences of activity. In fact, this is 150 centimeters. This is the length of the belt, and you can see that very nice trajectory occurs. This is on trial one. This is the situation on trial two, trial three, and many, many trials. It's almost always identical. It's like a robot. Initial condition is the same. One sequence. It repeats all the time. So now we turn on parasomatic inhibition. Well, when we turned off distal dendritic inhibition, nothing really happened with this sequence. I'm not telling you what else happened, but that was not so disastrous. But when we got rid of the parasomatic inhibition, what happened is that in this theta cycle, remember, there was a sequence. And that short-term sequence is predicting what happens at the long-term sequence. It is like in a Bach fugue, or in a Greek canon, that you just listen to a short period of time and you can make a prediction for the future, because from short time scale temporal relationship that can predict what is the longer time scale correlation. So by getting rid of the perisomatic inhibition, those neurons that fired at late phase came to the trough. And those neurons that fired in the early phase, they also came to the trough. If we probably got rid of all perisomatic inhibition by flooding the system with a lot of light, in our situation, probably affected no more than 15, 20 basket cells around the recorded pyramidal cell. But if we have done a lot more, then probably this would be all supersynchronous, and then we would call it an interictal epileptic spike. It would be so supersynchronous. Now, so this is the default, this is the normal pattern, and that is observed by downstream readers, or downstream reader mechanism. And the downstream reader mechanism are used and trained to figure out what is the thing here that you can call it information, or neural information. However, if you scramble it, then that's no longer read out as useful information. Okay? So if that is the hypothesis, that is the conclusion, that you have to have a beautiful sequence and you scramble it, then it should confuse the animal. So now we tested that hypothesis with another Frenchman, and we asked a very simple question, and we used a wonderful drug called marijuana. And marijuana is a very useful drug because, don't do it, because I know it's a disastrous consequence, but it's useful for us because at the recreational dose, it does not affect the firing rates of either pyramidal cells and interneurons. So the firing rates remain pretty much the same, but their timing is screwed up, and there will be a lot of problems of consequence of that. So then we ask what happens after marijuana injection, the CB1 receptor activation, with the place map. And the answer is nothing. There is absolutely no impact on it. We looked at something else, which is what I said. This is the sequential organization is expressed in a different way here, but you can see this is the beautiful organization called phase precession, and then this is very much perturbed here, and then it comes back after this. Then what we quantified is, then we can show that under the drug, or under the influence of the drug, the fine temporal relationship, the tens of millisecond relationship between neurons is completely gone. And in next level, we wanted to see how it affects behavior. And then we can show this here. This is the effect of the drug. This is showing that the normal synchrony is here, and the normal the impaired synchrony is shown with the green color. Now, once you have a physiological measure and you have a behavioral measure, you can correlate the two. And the message of this figure here is that the more you interfere with the precise timing in the tens of millisecond scale that corresponds to the gamma frequency oscillations, the larger the behavioral impairment. So once again, this animal cannot solve a spatial task under the influence of marijuana, even though all the place cells are in place. Nothing happened to the place system. It just changed the temporal relationships. And the consequence of this is a hypothesis, that the downstream readers that I would like to translate this cognitive map into action are confused, and they cannot any longer perform perfectly. Again, I ask the question, do I have time?
How long do you need?
8 more minutes. Okay, so the next question is, what determines the lifetime of this? Now, this is pretty complicated, and I don't expect that you will follow everything we are saying, but the gist of it is this. If we have large number of electrodes in the hippocampal regions, and we are recording both from the soma and the dendrites, then we can look from the local field potentials the reflection of the upstream information that comes to different dendritic segments. So for the CA1 pyramidal cells, there are two major inputs that come in. This is called the entorhinal cortex layer 3 and the CA3 system. And they generate different types of gamma frequency oscillations, not dramatically different, but they are different. But the important thing is that they have also different spatial locations on the dendrites. So if you have a large number of in this case, 64 recording sites, as well as you know something in the oscillation frequency, then you can segregate these two and say, I know at every single instant with relatively high accuracy whether this neuron is driven by the CA3 or this neuron is driven by the entorhinal cortex. So here's an example. The animal is running on the track, and this is the neuron's firing, and you would like to ask, how is this action, what is the source of this action potential drive? Is it the entorhinal cortex or the CA3? And now we say this is the entorhinal cortical input, this is active, and it sort of dies. And then this one is not so active, and then it is gaining and gaining more and more, and then the CA3 input comes in. Now, this is a very noisy measurement, so we need to concatenate many, many trials from many animals, and this is what we do. This is the place field, and we divide it into five identical divisions, and we average over and see what happens. So when we do that, what we find is that initially, the input, that is the initial condition to this neuron, is given by the entorhinal cortical input. And then that entorhinal input is getting weaker and weaker and weaker. In the meantime, the CA3 input is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. Now, it could be that this whole organization is inherited, it comes from the entorhinal cortex, but we had another question, whether this is organized locally, perhaps by the interneurons. Now, we bring back those neurons that we just talked about. These are the bistratified neurons that are terminating on the mid-apical dendrites and the basal dendrites, which is the terminal zone of CA3, and the other neuron is specific for the terminal zones of the entorhinal cortex. In other words, as a rule, I made this rule in 1984, and it was never violated, that every single excitatory afferent system in the hippocampus or in the neocortex has its own private set of interneurons. It's a private set of feedforward interneurons. So the perforant path is competing with the OLM cells, which are here. The CA3 has to compete with the inhibitory influence of the bistratified neurons. So how do we measure that this is in fact a useful thing and how they are activated? And what our measurements are indirect. What we are missing mostly in neuroscience is a direct measure of the synapse or synaptic weights. Everybody is talking about synapses, but it's very difficult to measure on the fly at the right temporal resolution, which is the resolution of behavior. The indirect way of doing that, at least between pyramidal cells and interneurons, is do what we call the spike transmission probability. The stronger the synapse, the higher the probability that neuron will discharge. So in this case of a pyramidal interneuron, you can see whenever the pyramidal cell fires, sometimes the interneuron responds, and it responds at a monosynaptic latency, which is 1 or 2 milliseconds, that gives you this very nice and very narrow peak. Now we can measure this narrow peak, and this is a proxy for the synaptic strength. Now we can do this in two ways. One is that your pyramidal cell is the same, and the target neuron is either a parvalbumin or perisomatic interneuron type, or a OLM neuron type, or any other type that you want. And what we find is something like this. When the pair is between a pyramidal cells and a parvalbumin-like interneuron, then you can see initially in the first quadrant, or the first quintile, it is very powerful, and then it loses strength. This other one, the pyramidal somatostatin-like connection, is the opposite. It's initially very weak, and it's getting waned, and so on, and this is the answer here. So remember, this is exactly the opposite of what you have seen before in the local field potentials, because these guys are competing. They are blocking their inputs. And the reason for that, because this is a depressing synapse, and this is a potentiating synapse. This is just the simple biophysics of the system, and the two allow you to do this. Now, this was done in the rat, and I said parvalbumin-like, and the other one was somatostatin-like, but I didn't give you evidence. But we can go back to the mouse, and I'll show you exactly the same thing. So what I have told you today is that there is a wrong philosophy that is driving today's neuroscience. We buy into this, and it is mostly sensory-driven. But I try to show you that most of the things that the brain does is self-organized. And this is the self-organization. This is the coronary discharge type of self-organization that allows that the brain can disengage from the world. And I showed you examples with baby kicks, that is the emergence of the sleep spindles, the head direction system, the entorhinal cortical grid system, and the hippocampal placer system. And I show you just in 1 second, one that you may be all familiar with this. This is Rizzolatti's mirror neuron system, which is based on pretty much the same principles. Here, the monkey initially, this neuron fires every single time the monkey is reaching, but the same neuron also fires when he sees somebody else, even the experimenter, reaching. This is why it's called the mirror system, and it reflects, of course, the coronary discharge idea. So let's revisit the beginning of this talk, namely that the goal of the simple organism and the complex organism is to predict the future. This prediction can be done in a very simple environment at a short time scale or at a longer time scale in a complex environment. And the key thing here is to disengage from the world. And this is the moment when we can talk about emergence of cognition. Thank you very much.